I'm Jane Wiecki, and this is the third in a series on children with disabilities, kind of what's to be done. And today we're going to focus on educational opportunities. That's sort of where we'll be. Were any of you at the forum last evening on children preschool? All right. I was interested in that in the forum as when we discussed daycare and preschools and sort of parent options for their children, what you can do, especially young children. And this morning I sat next to a young woman, Marianne, I don't know her last name, from Michigan someplace. And we talked about teen teaching and teaching styles and the fact that she's going to be finishing a degree and go back to teaching. And had she been away from school for a while, talked about different kinds of things in the teaching world, different kinds of teaching styles that are being used and sort of why. And because of that background, I thought, well, rather than start right in on the educational opportunities for children with disabilities, let's talk about children in general for a while. And that seems to be a place for us to start with your particular interests. And a little bit about what we know about their learning. Because as we have looked at what we can do for children with disabilities or learning problems, of necessity, we've had to look at how children who learn what we think is normally or in the more usual, how they learn, what helps them learn. And so that's maybe an appropriate place for us to begin this afternoon. Well, let me give you just a bit of research. Because about 15 years ago, this was the issue. We didn't know what to do with handicapped children by way of teaching. And so one of the places that a group of psychologists and people in education at Yale University decided to start with was with children in the third grade who were about to go into the fourth grade where the teaching is of more abstract concepts. We get into geography and some of the word problems in math, and you're sort of what children are expected to accomplish changes. And the question was, out of Head Start questions about children who were needed Head Start, were not getting educational opportunities early. Question was, what makes the difference between a child who is an A student and a C student? What has gone on in school that makes that difference? So all the graduate students went out and with observation sheets and that sort of thing to try to find what the teachers were doing and how the children were responding that made that kind of difference. And they couldn't find anything. So they decided, well, they tried first grade. Maybe whatever it was that was helping the children be achievers or non-achievers, given the same potential, you know, to start with. We're talking about normal, whatever that means, learners. So in first grade, couldn't find it there. Well, they decided it had to be in kindergarten. They were looking at what to do with Head Start, you see. So they looked in kindergarten to see what it was. Couldn't find it there. Whatever it was that was making the difference between achievers and non-achievers was established by that. Make a long story short, each year they'd go down. And finally, like 5 or 6 years later, they were with children who were 18 months of age, and that's where they found it. That the difference between children who are cognitively able, let me put it that way, and lesser able in the school world, had to do with the interaction style between the parents and the child, or the caregivers, let's say, and the child. And let me give you two examples to sort of clarify this. So for example, you have an 18-month-old child sitting on the high chair, a glass of milk, and a graham cracker. No, that's the usual. And the child begins to swirl the graham cracker in the milk, you know, not quite hungry anymore, just kind of playing with it. And one kind of sort of imperative style says, stop making a mess, you're through, wash your hands, and let's go. those are going to be the C kids. The other style says, well, you know, this is an overstatement, but we're talking about style. The other style says, say, look what's happening. Look, it melts. Or look at those crumbs going down there. And instead of, and you take what the child is doing and call attention to what's happening. We say, monitor it with language. So that the child's curiosity is raised about what is happening, and you put words of what is happening. 18 months. Let me give you another example. Let's have the child playing with toys on the floor. And you know the kinds of toys they give kids that age, pegs and in holes, that sort of thing. And the child is perhaps trying a peg that's too large to get into the hole. One style of interaction with the child comes, takes the peg and says, there, that's where it goes, and walks off. The other style takes the peg and says, looky, this one's too big, but words with it, this one is smaller, it will fit, now try this. So what you've done, instead of doing it for the child, is to talk about what does and doesn't work. And I'm not talking about paragraphs. You know, paragraphs overwhelm the child. A few words of helping the child to understand and to learn what's going on. And taking advantage then of the opportunities for learning to explain or to help with words instead to do it for them. That sort of interaction style with children is what made the difference between children who eventually were cognitively able, understood their world, could use language well, and did well in school. I think that has profound implications for not only parenting, but for teaching. So wherever, and that doesn't mean that you can't bring it on again later, but that's the time when that cognitive ability is really ripe for that sort of thing. And that was the age at which these researchers found that the differences were being made. That's pretty impressive data, isn't it? What that said to us when we were working with children with special needs was that when we had children in preschools, 4 or 5 or 3 and a half or whatever, who were cognitively at 18 months, they were not ready for sit-down-be-quiet tasks. What they needed was the taking advantage of the opportunities in the environment, which were magic moments, one of the teachers said. You take advantage of every magic moment to say, this is how it works, and this is what's happening, and notice this, and notice this, and that's a very different teaching style from bringing first grade teaching down to preschool. The desk work, the be quiet, the don't interact, the pay attention to, that sort of thing. And when we put those sorts of information together, then we began to think of what is a good preschool, what is a good daycare facility, what are the kinds of people you want interacting with your children, what do you want going on in a preschool or a daycare setting, and when you work with handicapped children, what kinds of things should be in their preschool environment which are perhaps different from the kind of preschool that or school setting that children who are learning normally are experiencing. Do you have any questions about that? Do you understand where we're going? Okay. One of the other things that I was talking about last evening, this morning to the gal about team teaching, is that when you want to take advantage of every moment and all the kinds of things, then you need, let's say, especially for handicapped children, then you need an environment where the people who work on the different developmental phases of a child can work together. So, for example, if you have a child who has a physical problem, the therapist can do only so much in a half-hour therapy session. And if she can work with a child for half an hour, but the child has a different habit the other 20 22, 24 hours, are you going to make any kind of impact? And so what needs to happen, for example, with a child who has, let's say, rotation problems in the pelvic area, is they have to say to the teacher and the parent, don't ever let this child sit like a Y. You know, the kids sit like this. Always sit this way. And if the therapist works for 3 days a week for half an hour and the child sits wrong the rest of the time, nothing's going to work. So we also learned that with especially young developing children, that when we put them in school situations and we worked together and knew what needed to be done, that the teacher could during the day reinforce or remind or assure that the child was using the new habits. It seems to me that that has a lot of implications for parents in home programs in schools for handicapped children. If you know what's going on, then you can take those magic moment opportunities through the day to sort of see that what the child knows how to do, the child does. That is fairly new in the special ed world. We didn't really need to do that with regular ed kids. They came home and they did their homework by themselves, and you didn't really, they got it pretty quickly, and they were able to generalize by using it. One of the things we're finding out about children with special needs is they, when we have them in school programs, they are, when we're pushing them to catch up, they're learning, we're pushing them so fast that we're forgetting the opportunities to let those habits settle in, to generalize to other situations so that they can, let me give you an example. The school teacher kind of way to teach the color red is to have red blocks or red circles and say, okay, point to red, point to orange, point to yellow, you know your colors. But the child doesn't have a concept of what I would call redness unless we say, oh, look at that pretty red sweater. And here's some red blocks today. And go get the red ball. Here's the red ball. And you put that concept together with other words so that it generalizes. And red is not that circle, but it is the concept of redness. That kind of teaching, which children who learn normally have, has to be done specifically for children in special ed programs. And I want to get back to that. But once a concept, an idea is taught in a school, it seems to me that the role of the family members, and I don't have grandparents here, it's something they want to know, is to use this in a number of different situations, not to be the first teacher. I think that if we make parents the first teacher to teach something you can't teach at school, we take away parenting. But if they have the fun of expanding that information, then you have sort of the teamwork that we're looking for. And we're going to talk about teamwork. If you're looking then for, let's go back to learning styles, if you're looking for a preschool or a daycare place or a nanny for a child, if you're substituting, whatever, in that preschool situation, you have to know what you're looking for. And one of the things that I would look for, given the research out of Yale, is an interaction style. Let me give you an example of an interaction style. You have a teacher or an aide or anybody who, when the child comes up and says, ball, and the teacher says, thanks. What's happened is that the interaction between the teacher and the child is over. You can do some teaching about that. You can say thanks, but you can say thanks for that big ball. Or thanks for the whatever it is, or oh, that's a pretty ball, go give it to, put something with it so that the child is involved with that ball a little longer to do something else with it. If I say to a child, where's your shoe? And the child goes, da, or gets it, that can be the end of the interaction, or I can maintain the interaction with the child and say, oh yes, under the chair. Even though the child can't talk, that goes into the information bank. So the thing that I would look for are staff who continue to engage the child, what I would say, one more turn. One more time. Just to add information, tell them how it's done, give them an example of the sentence, but one, so that the interaction style is not a your turn, my turn, the end, but a your turn, my turn, and your turn again. And hang in there one more time for the sake of the teaching and learning of the child. That is very much a parenting style. And parents do it almost automatically. But when you get into a school situation, somehow the teaching style is not the same. And what for young, you have something to say.
When you say parents do it almost automatically, that has been a very interesting thing to me in working with very young children, is the things that I assume parents do automatically, all parents don't do.
That's right.
And that is kind of a shocker, but something that we need to be aware of. Not all parents talk to their children.
Right. And that has a lot to do with how they learn, of course, is the way I think about it. And the other thing, you're right. In the first place, not all parents talk with children. In second place, there are cultural differences, racial differences in how they talk with children, and you have the mix together, and you have a sort of a dissonant learning style there. And the other thing is, if you're working with handicapped children, parents may have started out interacting, and the child, maturing more slowly, does not give the interaction back in the same manner that is expected, and parents pretty soon drop off the interaction style. So for example, if you have a child who even talks late, or who's a premature child, or who's been ill, or if the parents have been ill, or all of those kind of factors that affect the interaction style, let's say the child is developing slowly, for today's example, and at two is giving the signals that you expect of a 6-month. All right. We don't go back to pick up the 6-month nonverbal stuff. The child is walking perhaps, not talking to us, and we stop talking because we don't get any feedback. And we drop the interaction style, perhaps just at the time when it's most critical to keep it up. But that's because we're not getting back what we expect by way of exchange. So there are a number of factors that will affect the ongoing learning of a child if the interaction patterns are interrupted. And that's one of the most important sort of training things that we do, not only with teachers, but with parents, to pick that up again for children. And it's amazing that even when they pick up the interaction, well, first place they don't believe you, but it's important. But when you can pick up the interaction with a child who is at the vowel level of vocal production, for example, and talk back to, let's say, a 2-year-old the way you would to a 6-month-old. And it's more difficult because a 6-month-old is on your hip or in the high chair, and a 2-year-old is usually walking around. So it makes a different kind of interaction. But when you begin to do that, the child then will begin to move along the developmental sequence in language. And they may have stopped, because they're not getting the kind of interaction back which a child at that developmental level expects. So those are all kinds of things to be considered. And see, that interaction style too is not something that you can do for half an hour and turn off for 20 hours. It's an ongoing habit pattern. But anyway, those are some of the kinds of learning styles. And in regular preschool, are you teaching in regular preschool? Or?
Yes. Schools and some daycares. But it seems to me that this educational concept is important all the way through the child's career in school or whatever, is that they have to learn at their own pace and stay where they need to be until they've got that concept down. And I think we've been doing a better job of that in elementary schools of late. But they get to high school. I had a daughter who had lots of difficulty with math all through her career. And she gets to high school, and the choice is you take algebra and keep up with this pace that's set, or you don't take algebra at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I could see where she could have taken that 1 year course in a year and a half, mm-hmm. she would have it, mm-hmm. but that wasn't a choice.
You know, one of the things we could hope for that we learn, one that we could learn is to learn from what we're doing in special education about the options and opportunities which are available. We've come up with more options and more opportunities, more different kinds of options than we used to have in regular education at all, and it's beginning to spill over a little bit into the...
Because for whatever, how the lines work, right. I don't know, but some just need more repetition before it sticks.
And they have different... Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to what's going on with educational opportunities for children who are handicapped, and then maybe we can come back to what we might think about with children who are in regular school. There are opportunities now for children who have a variety of disabilities in our public schools, which were not available as recently as 10 years ago. I mentioned the other day, passage of House Bill 94142, which at the federal level mandated public education for all handicapped children, equal access to public education. And since that time, they started out with mandating public education for children grades 1 through the age of 21. Some states, in order to have with state monies, have gone down to include preschools, and some states now also begin providing education for children from year 1. For example, in Alaska, I know they have home-based programs for infants from the time they're born. When they're 2, they come maybe a couple days a week into what they call a center-based program, home-based program, 3 days, what they call center-based, 2 days, and by 3, they're in preschool 5 days a week. That's paid for public money. And busing is paid for, and the teachers are paid for, and it's at public expense. The federal mandate is for school age, and the May is at the state's, what did the state do about that, at their option. So anyway, there's a lot of help available. Let's talk a little bit about how you get access to it, because who knows when a neighbor of yours or a friend of yours may have a concern and you wonder how to, the computer term is how to access the system. First step is what they call focus of concern. I'm going to give you some magic words to go with it. So when you hear them again, you say, oh yes, I remember we heard those words. Focus of concern says, I have a concern about this child. Doesn't mean that you have a label, doesn't mean that anything else, that the parent has a concern, or the doctor has a concern, or you want to know whether this child would be better served with special programs rather than regular programs. It is sometimes frequently true that the child will become a focus of concern first after they've entered public school, and the classroom teacher will make that child a focus of concern. But if the child's disability has been obvious earlier, or if parents want to take advantage of some early education possibilities, like beginning with 3, they can go to the public school and the administrative office and say, I have a child that I think needs special education, and they will pull out focus of concern sheet. Okay. And that says, what's your concern, what's your problem, what's the problem, and some of those things. So if it's a medical concern, you say, well, the child has seizures, or child doesn't walk very well, or I'm concerned about his learning, or whatever it is, you put it down. And then you're ready for the second step, which is a testing step. The purpose of the step 2 is to document and to label. Now, I got very mixed feelings about labeling, especially young children, because early intervention is effective and sometimes those labels can change. But to get federal money, they have to have labels. And I know there's a lot of feeling in the country about not labeling, but, you know, that's just one of those things. What's it mean to document? Whatever you have put down on, or whatever has been put down on the concern, says to the people in the public schools that these are the kind of experts that should see the child. So if there is some concern about the way the child learns, or about the child's ability to keep up with the class, there will be a psychologist, an appointment with the psychologist, who will do testing, come out not only with a score, but with the child has can do this, some strengths and weaknesses, you see. Scores are important because you have to document need. And if it's a child of yours, don't get too concerned about the score. Don't argue about the score. The purpose of that is just to say, yes, the child is eligible. If there is, you worry about hearing, or if there's a concern about speech or language, there'll be an audit hearing test. There will be a speech-language test. The purpose is to document. There has to be, I'm going to say this kindly, a severe enough problem to qualify for services. That's the term. And so that's not the time to say, oh, my child can really do better. Just go with what happens so that you get services, okay? And do better later. So that's the purpose of that first testing. It's simply to say, all right, yes, there's a problem, and the child is eligible. Those are the magic words, to become eligible for special services. And states vary in what eligibility records they, eligibility standards they have. Some states will take children who are at risk. You see, the more children you take who are at risk, the more expensive it is. But in some states, they feel that's a good investment. They'd rather take a child who's at risk, move them up as fast as they can, and put their money into that early education than to not take a child who is sort of borderline and spend their money just on the more severely handicapped. So that varies by state, I guess is all I'm saying.
What's at risk?
A child who, or let me give it to you in terms of preschool standards in the state of Washington. Preschool standards in the state of Washington say is that a child must have a 25% delay in an area, in the area of motor delay, remember those developmental things, 25% delay or two standard deviations on tests or something like that in order to qualify. So if I have a one standard deviation delay, I don't qualify, but I'm at risk because I am a standard deviation below the normal for achievement, below the expectation. And so we can have a child, I guess that's just probably as good a definition as any. When you come out on the tests, if you don't have a severe enough score to qualify into the state standards, but you are still below what the expectation is for kids in public school, you may be a child at risk.
Is that because the federal law requires that the states to take certain children, but not required, but they may accept others? Is that?
That's right. And the states make their own rules and regulations to, depending on how much money they have to spend.
Oh, I see.
It's strictly a money matter.
Yeah, that's what you meant when you said if they take the at risk, then it costs more.
Costs
simply
more.
Because there are more children.
There are more children who fall between the. It's a sure fire they'll do fine in kindergarten. You know, just that.
Is there a preference
borderline
to use the available money in special education versus regular schooling? Or where does the state prefer the children?
The money is, it's not mixed. The money is not mixed money. The money for special for a hospital 941 for two kids comes from the federal government. You get a pot of money from the federal government. The state can decide what they want to do with that pot of money. But if they take children who are at risk, they may not spend as much money on the severely profoundly handicapped. So there's a pot, and you have to decide what you're going to do with it. And that's state rules and regulations will make that determination. And so for example, at the moment in the state of Washington, there is a lot of fuss about children with learning disabilities. There's been a lot of money recently going to severely and profoundly handicapped children to buy them computers and to have wheelchairs, motorized wheelchairs in the schools and all a lot of very expensive equipment in the school for the children who are severely handicapped who will never be self-sufficient, those kinds of kids. And parents of children with learning disabilities are saying, our kids are salvageable and we are not getting a good cut of the pie, and they're storming Olympia, and Department of Education to say it's time to reconsider how you're spending that money.
I'm going to put it rather crudely, but I think what you're saying is that if you have a child who's profoundly delayed, it may take, let's just say, $1,000 to move up one notch, mm-hmm, or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you have a child who is only slightly, mm-hmm, delayed, that $1,000 might take care of five children.
That's right.
Or if you have one, move up five notches.
That's right.
So
that's
the choice is, do you want to spend a lot of money for small gain, or
exactly,
do you want to ignore the
exactly
family handicap? That's it.
Exactly. And it depends on where your lobby is.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's that's part of the, and the lobby for children who are severely handicapped, for example, in a variety of ways, has been very strong, in part, I think, because the parents, they're very obviously, the parents are very tired.
Yeah.
And so they put a lot of energy into that.
So you're suggesting that it's as much a parental relief as
right,
it is a child education.
No, I'm suggesting that. And I think in the beginning they felt that great, great things could be done for all children. The days of behavior modification, which was one of the first types of learning techniques that came through, there was a feeling that if you could just work out your behavior modification systems well enough, that you could get children, almost regardless of how severely handicapped they were, to do pretty special things. And there were many research grants poured into that sort of an experiment. And people who wanted publicity felt that you got it most significantly by working with severely handicapped kids. Besides, you had fewer at a time. Lots of those kinds of academic questions that went into that. What happened is that they took a lot of severely handicapped children. They found out that they could not do a lot, but by that time, the population of severely and profoundly handicapped kids was in our schools, and the expectation was that they would continue to get that kind of money. They were the most visible earliest. The learning disabled children were not as visible, and have had the not as visible, I don't know what the incidence is, but they simply did not get early on the same kind of recognition. They are what is called mildly handicapped. In the worst of all worlds, they can at least be in some classrooms and get along, sort of. And that's what they were doing, dropping out by all means later and getting into trouble with the law. I think the research on that's fairly clear too for a number of them, but the most visible, for the sake of these first years of this legislation, was with the severely handicapped, and we haven't gotten away from it. They moved from that to young children, and the school population of kids called the learning disabled kids is still just sort of working along and not getting very much by way of good research even.
You may not feel comfortable in making a judgment at this point.
I never hesitate. I may not be comfortable, but I...
policy judgment, but it sounds to me like what you're saying is that we really would be accomplishing more help to more people if we simply recognize that some children are so severely handicapped and their limitations are so great and the prospect for development is so small that they ought to be handled separately and less expensive for them, and simply recognize that there's no
kindly
development.
But less expensively, I guess that's where I would be. I don't have any trouble with that personally as a judgment.
But you've got parents out there who are hoping against hope that something will happen and their child can be helped along, and it's a terrible.
What kind of parents are you talking about now? Do you have reference to?
Well, I think the parents who have a child who is very severely handicapped. And
I think the hoping against hope time has passed. with that population. They've done about as much as they can, and what people are recognizing now is that those children could be in school, but that the potential and what you hope for, what the IEPs, we haven't gone into that yet, are for, is simply to help them with living, home living skills, or to make them as to make it as comfortable for them to be with other people and as human as is possible.
What's an IEP?
IEP, well, you interrupted me.
Excuse me.
I wouldn't say that to anybody but my husband. Let's go back to where we were. Focus of concern, documentation. And after the documentation phase, when they do all the testing, phase number three is they will call the parents in to talk about the results of the testing. And that is going to be a placement meeting. So they talk about, this is what we found out, these are the kinds of needs, and this is what we have to offer you in this public school setting. This place, it is this school, may be a neighborhood school, it may not be a neighborhood school, depending on the disability or what the school district has. This kind of service, if there's busing, this kind of a class. I want to talk about the kinds of classes. And then we get back into this discussion that we just had. This kind of class. And parents should feel free to visit. They're saying, this is what our school district offers. Or they may say, we have a class in this school, which is 2 miles in this direction, and it has these facilities for you. Or we have this kind of a class in this school, and it has these kind of facilities for you, and you might wish to go look at them and see which one you prefer. So they may give you a choice, but they will know where they think your child will fit. And school starts in such and such a time, and if you've just moved, or you start the child next Monday or whatever, but this, the teacher's expecting you, we're going to send your records there. That's a very traumatic time, because not only getting into school, but it's where. What are the other kids like? What's the teachers like? What's it going to be like going to school? A lot of those kind of things. All right, so that's step number three, is that meeting. Step number four is a period of time, 30 days. 30 days, 30 school days from the time the child is enrolled, to 30 school days after the child is enrolled, let me put it that way, there will be a meeting between the parents and the teachers. And that at that time, the IEP will be developed. And that is the individualized educational program for that child. In that 30-day period, teachers and any specialists in the school, I'm talking about the occupational therapist, a physical therapist, a speech-language person, sometimes they have movement therapists, sometimes they have music therapists, there are all kinds of specialists, and teachers will be doing their own assessments. And what they will, the first assessment that was for placement only, that's what I call the quick and dirty. Just enough information to say, yes, the child qualifies. When the child qualifies, that's, they cannot do 4, 3, 6, 8-hour assessments. It's a qualification only. This time, this 30 days, this longitudinal kind of time, is to give teachers and therapists time over a period of several days, how the child feels each day after he gets acquainted and feels comfortable, to find out really what the child can do and cannot do, where that division line is in a variety of areas. So they'll know, one know, let's say, how the child is able to cut, handle scissors, handle blocks, if it's a preschool child, if he has any number concepts, if his language, how well he talks, how well he hears, if it's a physical therapist, how well he uses his body, how, you know, what the fine and gross motor coordination is like, all of those kinds of things. And they will have developed, by the time the parents come, some goals and objectives and a plan for that child. It's a much more organized plan. Regular school, there's a curriculum through which all children go. And all kids have these ad facts, the subtraction and mismultiplication. In special education, each program is individualized for the child. That's the difference. That's why the ratio is kind of at most 12 to 1 with an aide in most special ed classrooms. So at the meeting, which the parents have with the classroom staff and any specialist, there are pieces of paper with goals and objectives, and this is sort of an agreement time. The teachers, and this is our plan. And parents have an opportunity to alter it, to change it, or to sign it. So there will be things, let's say, for example, let me give you a preschool example and let's say a first grade example. They're not so graded. Let's take a young child who can't handle scissors very well. And one of the things you want to have the child do is fine motor coordination well enough to cut a circle. So that's as specific enough as to say the goal is that by next June, this is September, the child will be able to cut out a circle which is 6 inches in diameter along a heavy line. So you want to be able to cut that smoothly and well. Objective number one, the child will be able to make 3 1-inch snips on a solid line. Well, that's a long way from the, but that's where we start. And people in special education should know what the steps are to get to that cutting skill. And they start with how you handle scissors just like that, and then they'll get to longer lines and curved lines and finally get to that circle. And so that says to you, this is what we hope this child will learn by June, and here's where we're starting. And it also makes them accountable for their federal money, because those are kept, and the child has to have programs in all of the so-called deficit areas in order to qualify for the federal money, and their monitors that come from the federal government periodically. Then comes any public school that provides these programs, pull any child's IEP and see if the programs are being continued.
Would these things be worth doing if it was not for what's necessary to do them in order to get money for the program? And do you think that's a good way to set it up, that this child should learn to cut a circle, or should you go more by the child's interests?
Depends on what your goals are in the long run. What they're doing is preparing children for the public school kinds of things. And that is a variable which depends on kind of what skills the child has. For example, if we have a severely and profoundly handicapped child, I'm going to say a really severely handicapped institutional type of child, then it's going to be a feeding program. The child should feed itself. Or a child will learn to pull itself to a standing position, help himself at the toilet, or to wipe the table, or to fill a glass, or to feed, those kinds of self-help skills. And the judgment about what kind of curriculum is most appropriate for the child is really part of what special ed training should be about for the teachers. And that's where parents and teachers need to become teams, for example, to decide on whether that is the, what's the purpose of that cutting program, for example. Well, it is, in the first place, a fine motor coordination thing. It moves from that sort of thing to finer muscle, eventually to writing. It's one of the pre-writing programs to work on some of those. So you decide whether that's where you want to be. And parents frequently say, I don't see sense in that. And that's when the teacher or the principal or whoever is working with it has to give the rationale. And if the parents say, I don't want that program, you have a chance to say that. I would rather have this. See if it's possible in that setting.
Do the parents get to make that decision?
Yes. The IEP needs to be signed by parents and everybody who's going to work with that child, that this is what we will do. And the parents get to talk. Sometimes the parents will say, I don't like that and I won't sign it. And your choice then is to take the child out of school or to leave the child in school and simply say, that doesn't go with my approval. I don't think that's very important. But as long as the child is in school, there must needs to be an individualized program for that child. Or the parents can request, I'd like more time of this and less of this, and sometimes that is possible and sometimes that is not possible, depending on staff and how many people and how many kids and how much time the other children take. So there are those, but it is an agreement, and when children themselves are old enough and cognitively able, the child is also a part of that agreement. So it is a school, parent, child agreement form. This is what we're going to work on. And from that, children in regular school are beginning to contract with teachers. You know, but I will do this kind of work in this period of time. Or even so as to say, this is what you do if you get an A, and this is what you do if you get a B, and you can decide what you want and contract and do it.
Which works beautifully with some children and other children. That's
right,
exactly.
That's
why I was asking this question.
That's right.
Necessary for all children.
Mm-hmm. But this is necessary for all children who are in special education programs that get any federal money. So I think it's important to know that's the process. That's the process which comes from getting federal money. It's a fairly lengthy one, but it's very carefully drawn up. There's a lot of hoops to go through, but everything has to be documented. And the program that's provided or written for the child's work during the year comes from those assessment tools. And when you meet for an I, what they call the IEP, you ask to see those tools. I want to know where it came from and why, and talk about the curriculum and the rationale, and parents need to know. After all, they're your kids. And that's when that one goes. So within that sort of a placement setting, I was going to get a question I thought we might want to talk about. It has to get back to children with learning disabilities. There are a number of kinds of placements. There's what's called a self-contained classroom. Now, most kindergartens are self-contained classrooms. You have kids in a classroom and a teacher. And maybe an assistant, and they stay in that classroom for all of their work. Most children who are severely and profoundly handicapped are in a self-contained classroom. There will be 6 children with a teacher and an assistant, plus special help. That's fairly expensive, you see. And depending upon the school district and what they have to offer, and if this is the child's first year or not in the classroom, they may say, we'll start with a self-contained classroom. Those are the magic words that are put on the form you have to check. Is it a self-contained? Is it a resource? Is it a mainstream? All of those are options. So self-contained is one. Resource room is one that's used with children who have learning disabilities not as severe as to require self-contained. In recent years, they are trying to get more and more away from self-contained so that children who have special needs have as much access as possible to their peers, to other children in the school, and that other children in the school become comfortable with them. So a resource room is a very frequently used option for children who are less severely handicapped, who are hearing impaired. For example, you might start a child who is hearing impaired with a self-contained classroom teaching total communication, or learning to lip read, whatever. When the child has some academic skills, you might send the child out and give the child an opportunity to mainstream into a class, an art class, with hearing children. Could get along. Might not get along very well mainstreaming in a reading class, or surely not in a spelling class, but could mainstream into an art class. So you could go from a self-contained classroom to some of those mainstream streaming options. Resource room is sort of a different kettle of fish. It's a room, to what's called a resource room, a teacher, to which children will go for one period or more periods for special kinds of resource training. The learning disabled child who has special problems in reading, does well in math, for example, may do math with his friends and music with his friends, but have his reading in a special resource room. Go to Mrs. Jones' class for reading. May go to two or three resource rooms for specialized kinds of things. So that would put the child basically in a program with peers for, so that he, that child feels like he's with these other kids. But is special ed in certain kinds of rooms. So for example, when I first came to Seattle, I worked with the hearing impaired kids. I was a resource room teacher. Children came to me for lip reading classes, for speech and hearing, and for tutoring. They carried the rest of their classes with the kids. This was high school, when we were able. But they had some resource work. And resource rooms are quite popular, or quite widely used, let me say, in fourth, fifth, and sixth grades, and in junior high and high school, especially for children who are learning disabled. It's the choice option for those kinds of kids. It's a mixed bag. Sometimes they do well. Sometimes they really need a self-contained classroom for practically the whole time. And some schools are able to offer that, some aren't. So we have self-contained classrooms, you have resource rooms, and you have mainstream options. And the woman who sat over on this side, I think Monday, wants to talk about a child, a slow learner, retarded child, who is in her third grade class and she doesn't know what to do with it. That child has been, quote, mainstreamed without the skills to succeed. Or she wouldn't be so concerned about it. And part of the secret of this, of the successful mainstreaming, is to be sure that when you put a child in, it isn't just to sit there, but to participate, and to have the skills to participate. So that's, any questions about that?
Who decides whether or not to put them into the school?
Into, which, a, you mean into?
The regular school, the mainstream, is that again an IEP?
That's kind again of? An IEP, and IEP decision, and sometimes you see parents will insist on the mainstreaming option when the child's not ready. And rather than fight lawsuits or hearings, because they're very expensive and lengthy, sometimes the school district will say, well, we'll give it a try. And depending upon how sensitive parents are to what's right for the child, or what's right, what parents want to say, it's more or less successful. Sometimes you give it a try to see and then decide it wasn't a good decision. It's my judgment that you can pretty well tell before you do that by giving a child an opportunity to visit. And by see. But you see, giving a child an opportunity to visit takes extra time from the teacher who lets the child visit, takes time from an observer who wants to come and see how it's done. That's a time factor, it's a price factor to try those things out. And as this kind of special education gets more and more expensive, some of those time factors, expensive items, get cut a little bit. And so, but it is a decision, a mutually made decision between staff, teaching staff, parents. There's always an administrator at the IEP meetings, so that those kind of, so that if there are any questions, that doesn't become confrontational.
Do you know if there's any sort of research about two systems?
No. It depends on the child, it depends on the school district, it depends on what other kinds of children there are in that district. So you can't tell, not every city has a certain percentage of retarded and a certain percentage of learning disabled and a certain percentage of these, and you have to have a certain number of children to be able to have a teacher. And sometimes you get bad mixes, and I think that's what you're asking.
And are parents very concerned about the stigma attached? If they're in a regular classroom, people say she's the dumb one, or she's in the other class,
sure.
That's the dumb class.
Sure. Sure. There's a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of an issue that we want to talk about later. What are the issues? I mean, I'm just talking about educational opportunities today. And that's, but there's parental pride. Some parents want the child at the local school and they don't want that child on a school bus. Okay, what happens? Sometimes you go to a school that bus the child to school because the teachers and the children in that school have had special children there long enough that they are accepting and kind, and there's no stigma in that school where there is in this one. Sure, I think there are a lot of those factors that we haven't talked about that sort of border on what we talked about yesterday, family pain. Some of those good. And there's one of those things where sometimes none of the answers are good ones. You have to decide what you're going to do to support the child. What if you want an education for the child, or just want the child to, how important is education is over against neighborhood school, playing with peers, what can you do about it? What are some of the options?
Well, is there a socialization factor value there that makes it worthwhile sending a child with peers, even though she or he may not be able to intellectually develop?
Yeah. And how many ways can you do that?
I don't know.
Well, that's a question. Do you? yes, there's a factor.
But the teacher has to want that to happen.
That's right. But how about
it has to seem important so that she will spend some time at it.
How about the peers in the neighborhood? You see, I would think that on an IEP, it would be important to have the children that just go to gym learn to play games together. Because that has to do with playing with your peers. You see, that to me is a very appropriate IEP goal. Interact appropriately on the playground. Or to learn to play interaction games.
This should be an education for the other children too.
Absolutely. And there frequently is. And
that's why
I'm saying that it may be worthwhile to get on the bus and go across town for 20 minutes to a school that has had special ed children there for a while. So the other children in the school manage wheelchairs, you know, help kids in the cafeteria. There is a comfort level of having seen enough of those and been in a position to help. I worked at a school for handicapped children where we had all kinds of they're all handicapped. But we had severe and profoundly handicapped kids in wheelchairs who could not hold their heads up. But the learning disabled kids came down and took all those kids to the bus. I want to get my kid, you know, just a sense of importance and ownership, and they called them by name, and they were their project, and it was a wonderful kind of thing to see. That comfort level, that helpfulness developing, that's one of the things that is going on in some of the other schools. Teachers have to watch what the kids say on the playground. You know, you have to talk about it in the schools. There are now, I've noticed in the library, a number of books out about kids with handicaps and how they feel about going to school, and those books are read by librarians to the children in the schools. But it's a whole educational system. And the other thing is not to put the kids in a situation that they can't handle. You don't just throw them out like you do kind of normal kids to hope that they can get along, because sometimes they can't. But anyway, we're out of time. Any last questions before we... The IEP is new. I think it's still evolving as more and more programs are made available, that we're talking about today, opportunities to children. We try things, some, as you were saying, some are for some children and not for somebody else. Depends on the district, on the teachers, on how many handicapped children there are, and what they can provide. And sometimes parents move to another city in order to get the kind of program that they need that's very disruptive to family life. I know there are a couple of school districts in the state of Washington where there are service people get sent from all over the country to these two cities because of the school systems that are available. So we'll stop it there.